Okay, continuing with Sandy Weinreb on 31 July 78.
Well, the next step was to compute the deterioration in signal to noise due to 1-bit quantization.
Fanfleck hadn't worked that out.
I don't think so. No, I don't think he did. Of course, Van Fleck worked it out before there was digital processing. That is, he didn't think of it in terms of a 1-bit quantized signal. It was just if you had hard limited a signal, what happens to it? There was also some work in the Harvard Acoustics Lab. Farron and Hills, that had looked into hard limiting of Gaussian noise signals.
Does this mean clipping, essentially, when you say hard limiting?
Yes. So I worked on the increase in the variance of the signal, and that was fairly easy to compute for the autocorrelation function.
Mm-hmm.
But I was really interested in the variance of the spectrum,
mm-hmm.
which requires knowing the covariance of the autocorrelation function. And that always eluded me. I think until just a few years ago that was an unsolved, as far as an exact solution was concerned. So I found it through a computer simulation
Monte
experiment.
Carlo sort of.
Yes.
I see. So that was just an empirical number until a few years ago.
Well, the increase in the autocorrelation function is pi over 2, the increase in the variance of the autocorrelation function. Increase of the square root of the variance, the RMS deviation, is pi over 2. And that, you sort of expected that to be true of the spectrum, and you could prove that on the average of the spectrum, the increase would be pi over 2. But well, I guess I told Wiesner about this 1-bit method, that looked like a good thesis to apply that to looking for the deuterium line. I planned out a receiver and made a cost estimate, which I believe came to a $60,000 NSF grant, mm-hmm. which Wiesner applied for. Some was overhead and so forth. I think it left about $30,000 for equipment. Some of it was my salary for a year and a half.
Sure.
So we applied for that grant. And I forgot who the NSF guy was, Jeff something. He was quite good. We got the grant. Prior to getting it, or maybe it was after getting it, we went to Lincoln Lab to try to interest them in building the digital correlator. And that is Wiesner. And I went out there, and I remember there was an estimate of $200,000 to build it. That is, it was something like it was going to require 1,000 flip-flops and $200 a flip-flop,
mm-hmm.
which is $200,000. which they didn't have that kind of money to just throw into something like that.
Yeah.
And I had budgeted $20,000, and in fact did build it for that. It was built by, was that truck again? Yeah, it was built by a contract to a company, Control Equipment Corporation. It was a little tiny company run by somebody else who used to work for Ewan Knight. Harry Adams was his name. And for $19,000, they built the timing and correlation part of the correlator, that is.
To your specs.
Yes. Yeah. It did not include the counters that accumulated the autocorrelation function. This was a 21-channel machine, and the counters, it was 21 of them, and they had to be able to accumulate for several hours at 300 kilohertz,
mm-hmm.
And then manually read out. And I think there was something like 20 flip-flops in each one. So that was about 400 flip-flops. It was a large part of the hardware. And those I designed myself. And there was a husband and wife that wired them. They did them at home at night while watching television. And these counters had neon bulbs to read out,
right.
And also an electromechanical counter that did the slow counting. Some more noise. Well, the correlator finally got built, and
how are you doing the transform now? Was that
the idea was to write down the numbers out of the correlator every 4 or 5 hours. And then punch these on cards and transform them. At Green Bank, there was a 1620, IBM 1620 computer that did the transform.
So you'd have 4 or 5 hours of integration,
mm-hmm.
and then you just write down the number, I see.
Mm-hmm. The biggest problem was a few of the electromechanical counters miscounted, and the correlation function had to be extremely accurate. I mean, just missing one of a few counts
mm-hmm.
in the electromechanical counter, which was some valid numbers. That was terrible. Well, this only happened on one of these. What I did was run the machine for days, just having everything, all the counters should count the same.
Mm-hmm.
I've run it for a week even, and find one electromechanical counter would be a few counts off. And that worried me to no end.
This is a few counts out of how many now?
On the electromechanical counter, I think it was a six-digit counter. It would be close to the end, so say out of a million.
Mm-hmm.
But the number was pretty significant by the time you integrated that long. So I think I made a scheme. I used a scheme that I reversed the phase of the signal. This was a switched radiometer. So I could make it so drop counts would average out in the long run. The rest of the receiver was solid state. It was one of the... There was a few tubes in it in different places, but it was mostly solid state. It was also an automatic balancing system. It had a noise diode whose temperature was automatically adjusted to balance
right.
the antenna temperature. And the front end was housed in a refrigerated box, a temperature controlled box that Ewan Knight bought for me. That is, Ewan made a contribution to the thesis, which I think this box was $5,000 or so.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out to be a disaster, the box. The refrigeration system was very unreliable. And when I finally went down to Green Bank and it failed, I replaced it with fans and a proportional control heating system. But the front end tube was a tube, 417 or 416B, I think it was. It was the lowest noise front end tube available at the time. System temperature was, I believe, around 1,000 degrees. The rest, and it was a four-channel receiver, that is, it would integrate, when you were in comparison, another receiver would be integrated on signal.
I see. You had two front ends.
Had four front ends, because it was dual polarization. Dual polarization all the time type of...
What was the purpose of the dual polarization?
It was all to gain integration time. That is, I knew I was going to need months of integration time. And,
route
instead
two
of eight
times
months.
It makes a big difference
right.
When you're getting into months. Right?
Yes.
One other question I'm not clear on is your total bandwidth. Was that limited by the availability?
Correlator.
In the correlator, right?
Yes.
Was that limited?
Yes. The clock rate of inexpensive logic elements was 300 kilohertz, perhaps 500 kilohertz. I think I the most I could run my machine at that time was a clock rate of 300 kilohertz, which would analyze about 100 kilohertz band.
Mm-hmm.
And I could analyze four 100 kilohertz bands, all summed together into the counters. So I had a four-channel receiver. The IF, all that was transistorized, a nice little slide-out drawer. And I thought the equipment looked very nice. I paid a lot of attention to the appearance of it. Professor Bose at MIT helped me with it.
Mm-hmm.
Wiesner sort of didn't have time to come into the lab and really do anything, but Bose, who's the Bose of the Bose
right.
speaker systems,
right.
He was very nice about discussing problems.
But Wiesner was actually your advisor?
Yes.
Well, how did the observations go?
Well, negatively, I guess, that is, we've got the equipment on the telescope. There was no signal. The fluctuation was going down the way it should. That is, I felt the equipment was working.
Mm-hmm.
I had a few ways of checking the equipment. One was an artificial deuterium line, a cavity that could produce an artificial line. It wasn't a cavity. There was cavities in the front end as interference filters. But there was, I generated a noise spectrum that I could adjust how strong the line was in the spectrum. Generated it from low frequencies because it had to be a narrow line. Before I left MIT, I mean, I could detect, I don't know how strong, the signal that I would get if the deuterium to hydrogen ratio was the terrestrial ratio, I could detect.
After how long?
Probably a few days of integration. Now, it must have been longer than that, because I only got to half the terrestrial abundance. Well, I think that was probably at about a 5 sigma or 3 sigma level.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Well, I can check these numbers.
Yeah, yeah. That's in the paper. But nothing bad happened. That is, I didn't get any false signals, but I just was getting a nice straight line. And the integration went on and on, sort of broke it up into 2-week segments. There may have been a hint of a line in the first couple of weeks. It just happened to be how the noise fluctuations were. But it just didn't prove out.
So we're looking at Cass A now primarily?
I was looking at Cass A almost entirely. That is, I see now that was a mistake. But I believe so strongly that I should look where there was strong hydrogen, that it wasn't going to vary. Wherever there was hydrogen, there would be deuterium. I think we maybe spent a little bit of time working with Sagittarius, maybe Cygnus. I was very impressed with Green Bank, the help I was given, telescope operators. All the facilities were there, the telescope, the operators, nice lab, nice test equipment. Very few astronomers. I think there was 100 employees, 3 astronomers, Ejian, Drake, and Bennett. But it was an ideal place for me to go. There was a new house to live in. Delightful place.
Well, you obviously decided to stay on pretty soon after that.
I guess I was only going to go for 3 months, but then did a Zeeman experiment. I think I modified the equipment and got some help from Menon, or Menon may have suggested it or helped me with it in some way.
This had been tried at Jodrell.
Yes.
I think by the skewer, perhaps. What's his name?
Davies.
Shooter and Davies. I
think. Yes.
Right. But you could do it more sensitively.
Yes. And I got another negative result, which I think is correct. That is, at the level that I said it was below a certain level.
And now, where did you look for that?
Let's see. I believe that was also in Cass A.
Yeah.
Might have looked somewhere else. But I was pretty discouraged at that time, the 2 negative experiments. And people at MIT were dubious about the thesis, I would say. I had a hard time with the thesis at MIT. It's sort of understandable. It was a new equipment technique, and I had 2 negative results, both of which there had been what we now know to be false positive results, but weren't known at that time.
Well, had there been some positive Zeeman at that stage? I'd forgotten that.
I may be wrong about that, but I thought...
I'm not sure. I'll check that out. I
thought that there were. So I had a hard time defending the thesis.
They weren't maybe sure your equipment was working.
That's right. That's right. I think I probably failed the first thesis exam or the first general exam, or maybe both. I remember taking a lot of the exams or taking some of them over again.
What did you have to do to satisfy you next time around?
I don't know. I may have gotten a letter from Drake saying that he thought it was a good experiment. I did have this simulated line result.
But not you didn't put that together as a result of the criticisms of your first...
No. I had done that initially. So they eventually graduated me.
That's really amazing, because I always consider that thesis one of the classics in radio astronomy.
Well, I realize now it was an excellent thesis. I mean, both the astronomy part of it, building the equipment, the correlation receivers had been used so much since then. But I didn't know at the time it was a good thesis, and MIT didn't either. I mean,
there wasn't anyone really championing.
There wasn't anybody there. Barrett came around that time. He probably helped, but he just came in. I think he may have been in on the second thesis exam.
Mm-hmm.
Lilly was on the thesis exam committee also. So I eventually passed. And
that was 62 you passed?
Yes.
Let me just ask, to summarize, what was about the correlator. You say the basic techniques of the correlator have been put forth by Wiesner and others.
Well,
I'm trying to get an idea.
Correlation techniques without clipping is the Wiener-Kinchin theorem, Norbert Wiener. Relationship between power spectra and autocorrelation function had been done by mathematicians many years ago, in the 1940s. So I knew that I could either build a processor that computed either the correlation function or the spectra. I could get one
just whichever,
the other.
Whichever turned out to be most...
Yes, and then I saw that it was easier to compute correlation function digitally. And then I saw that you didn't need many bits. One bit was sufficient to do it.
Now, but had correlators of a similar nature been built for other purposes in physics? Or
for submarine sonar work. Farron and Hills and build a correlator. I believe it was an analog correlator.
And also there was the analog correlator by, what's his name? He's now at Penticton. I think it was sort of a development, perhaps simultaneous, maybe a little bit later than yours, but rather independent. Ed Argo. Did he not build a...
That I don't know.
An analog correlator about that time?
I don't know.
So it was mainly in the application to astronomy, the clipping aspects, and making a workable system, of course, worrying about all of the level problems and so forth. That was the new aspects.
The digital processing was a new aspect.
Yeah. What about the, now, of course, one great advantage that one thinks of is the ability to change bandwidth so easily. Was that foremost at that time in any sense? Or
that was...
sort of a byproduct.
Byproduct. I think even in the original machine, I could change the bandwidth over 4-to-1 range.
But that wasn't sort of a motivation for you?
No.
To go for that sort of thing?
Okay, so you had your degree, and then I'd like to talk about the experiment also. Was that the next thing, or was there something else?
No, that was the next thing. That was primarily Barrett's, Alan Barrett's. Push for that, suggested it.
He had looked at an NRL many years before unsuccessfully.
Yes. I was sort of discouraged. I didn't believe any lines other than the hydrogen line existed. But I modified the equipment. It had to work in a wider band. I think I got it up to 250 kilohertz bandwidth. And interfaced it with the computer at Millstone. Mm-hmm. John Henry actually did the interfacing. I modified the car layer. This was a nice thing to have the online computer. You know, it was the first time we had that, so you could really see the spectrum right away. And I don't remember what the front end was, whether I built that or something existed at Millstone. Anyway, we put that together, and pretty sure it was the first night we saw OH, and I just couldn't believe it. Litt Meeks was always an optimist. He was sure from the beginning we were going to detect it. I was sure we weren't. And the bump appeared in the noise, and I thought it was noise, but it was about at the right place. It didn't have quite the shape, but it wasn't a simple line.
Yeah.
But it was right there on the screen. It was
this is Cas A.
Marvelous.
Cas A again.
Yes.
But you knew the H1 absorption was complicated in Cas A, so perhaps that wasn't that surprising. That you could see it more than one feature in OH.
But it didn't look the same. We looked again the next night and got the same bump. We still weren't sure, you know, if it was interference or something, but it didn't take long. You know, within a week, we were pretty sure. Don't remember whether we looked somewhere else, when we started looking somewhere else. I mean, OH is much stronger in other spots that we didn't look for. I think maybe the next step was finding polarization in OH. I don't remember whether we did that or.
Well, now the Corset had to wait for the discovery of the emission.
Yes. Okay.
And let's see now. How does the emission story go? That was Alan Gunderman and at Harvard and then at Berkeley. It was sort of a simultaneous thing to find an emission. As part of absorption studies, that people began noticing these positive things, and polarization came quickly. But were you ever involved in that, in the emission?
Yes, well, in the early, in sort of several months, that there was a few groups that were, we were one of them, Berkeley, and I think the Swedes were getting involved also.
Yeah, it could be.
There were sort of new discoveries every few months, you know, emission or the line ratios weren't coming out right.
Polarization,
circular polarization. There was a lot of excitement.
Yeah, upper limits. And there were also time variations were suspect.
That came
they're,
later.
They're still suspected. Those variations, I think, now are most of them suspect. Because of pointing problems, but in fact, some of them are probably right.
Yes.
This is all in 64 now, is it not?
Yes, I came to Green Bank as an employee in October of 65. And OH was discovered in 63, so most of this was in 1964.
Yeah.
We started building a really nice car lighter for Lincoln Lab that is a 100 channel, 10 megacycle clock rate car lighter.
Which was used for a decade.
Yes, yes. Green Bank started building the car lighter. Art Shalloway came to work for Green Bank. Started doing that.
If I could ask you one general question, although you did not take part in radio astronomy in the 40s and the 50s, you certainly have thought a lot about receivers and so forth. As you look at the development of the field in antennas versus receivers, do you see one or the other as being vital, or do you see the direction of the field as having been set by receiver technology? I guess what I'm saying is I'm more used to thinking in terms of how the antennas have shaped the field. Do you have any thoughts on how the receivers have shaped the development of the science?
I think that after the initial discoveries, receivers have shaped a lot of the science. In terms of, I always felt it at Green Bank, if we could build a receiver that was a factor two or three more sensitive, some new science would probably come from it. It didn't matter what the frequency was. I think that's probably still true. There's a factor two or three more sensitive, including any atmosphere. In the earlier days, you could do, you hadn't done the science yet with the existing receivers.
There was so much out there.
Yes, you could just put together an ordinary receiver and look at a particular frequency, I mean hydrogen, and find something. You didn't have to build a better receiver. Right now, that's true in the submillimeter. But it's no longer true, say in the 100 gigahertz region. You got to build a better receiver to find something new. You still do good science, I guess, with existing receivers.
So do you think that's a fair appraisal then, that really up through the 50s, that it was more or less building a different kind of antenna would be the way to make the discovery rather than to build a far better receiver?
Not just building a different antenna, just looking for something different.
Well, but I would argue, though, that the antennas have, as soon as you built one that had a different capability, either more sensitive, of course that's virtually the same as having a more sensitive receiver, but or a different spacing or a different way of looking at the sky, that new features came up that weren't seen before. And like you say,
that's true to some extent, but for example, the hydrogen line didn't require building a different antenna. I mean, it was a simple form. It didn't require any lower noise receiver that existed probably 15,
but it did require some special techniques. I mean, the frequency switching is not a straightforward thing and certainly novel.
Well, the frequency switching, Dickey switching came in World War II. It didn't have to be frequency switch to do hydrogen.
No, it didn't have to be either.
No, I think it was more just knowing where to look. The technology was there. It had been there for since the 1940s. Uh,
more knowing.
Just look, the sky was so big that the cleverness came in knowing what to look for and where to look for it, rather than.
Yeah.
You know. But do you think that phase has sort of come to an end, or do you think?
I think there's still a mixture of experiments of types that come about because of advances in equipment. Others just looking in the right place.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much. That ends the interview with Sandy Weinreb on 31 July 78.